Sri Chaitanya Manavistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Sayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sapadantikam. E Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute. Jayatam surato pango mama manda mateagati matsa vasa padam bojo radha madanao mohano divya vindananya kapajumada sriman rasa Divya Vinda Nanya Kapalu Mada Sri Man Ratna Gada Singha Sanasto Sisi Radha Govinda Devo Prasthya Libyo Savyamano Smarami Sri Man Rasara Sarambi Vamsi Vattata Stita Karsham Vena Svanaya Gopi Gopi Natta Sri Stuna Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavanishwari Vrishavanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Pre Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Adaita Gadadha Sri Vasari Govaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Bhishma Dev has just left this world, and all the devotees are feeling mixtures of happiness and intense misery and separation from him. After all, he was shot through with so many arrows. How could those who love him tolerate seeing him in such a pain condition? So he was released from that difficult situation and went back to Godhead. And therefore, the devotees felt pleasure for Bhishma Dev. But for themselves, they were feeling intense separation, because such a great soul was no longer on this earth. And this is what gives the earth life, when the great souls traverse the earth. Otherwise, it's quite dead. It's just matter interacting with matter. But when holy people, saints, sadhus, are on this world, in this world, they carry with them the internal energy, giving life to hard hearts which are of stone. So Bhishma Dev, a great Mahajan, had left. So then Yudhisthira, who had been feeling so much doubt and frustration and anguish due to so many people having been killed on the battle of Kurukshetra to instate him as the king, he had that anguish removed by the instructions of Bhishma Dev, who told him specifically how to rule the world, and also told him that this great devastation was actually Krishna's arrangement. So Yudhisthira, naturally, after the funeral ceremony was performed, then in the 10th chapter, Shonaka Rishi inquires in the first verse, what happened next? Bhishma Dev had left, Yudhisthira went to Hastinapur to console Dhritarashtra, Gandhari, and to rule the kingdom. Then what happened? Did he actually do it? He had agreed to do his duty. His illusion was removed by Bhishma Dev. He was about to take the position, occupy the royal throne. Well, what happened next? So Sonaka Rishi asks about this, saying, after killing his enemies who desired to usurp his rightful inheritance because he was due the throne, how did the greatest of all religious men, Maharaj Yudhisthira, assisted by his brothers, the other Pandavas, rule his subjects? Surely he could not freely enjoy his kingdom with unrestricted consciousness. What does that mean? Sonaka Rishi says, certainly he wasn't the kind of ruler who would just see the kingdom and the people within the kingdom as something to exploit, something meant for his pleasure and certainly not meant for his enjoyment. He wasn't that kind of a king. Quite the opposite. Because Yudhisthira was not the personification of irreligion, and actually it's interesting how we'll hear later, the personification of irreligion falsely takes the position of king too. Because the most irreligious people, powerful and irreligious people, they aspire for these positions of great power and control because they get a thrill out of exploitation, and the more they can exploit, they love the positions of power, so they can exploit and exert their influence and enjoy. But Sonaka Rishi said that Yudhisthira couldn't have been like that. So what did he do? So Sutta Goswami replies in text 2, Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the maintainer of the world, became pleased after re-establishing Maharaj Yudhisthira in his own kingdom and after restoring the Kuru dynasty, which had been exhausted by the bamboo fire of anger. So Krishna desired that Yudhisthira Maharaj be placed as the king because he was religious. He was the personification of religiosity. He was goodness personified. And he wanted, it is essential that such a person rule. Why is it essential? Because then the citizens are benefited so much. Naturally, it occurs. It occurs naturally in so many different ways. In the simplest way, when the rulers are exemplars of goodness, of morality, of integrity, then naturally the citizens follow, just naturally. Because naturally the citizens want heroes. And because this is the age of the anti-hero, the anti-hero, where there are no heroes, the heroes don't possess heroic properties, the people who are looked up to, they are not exalted personalities, and naturally the people become degraded. But we can see how the people in general, they must have heroes. And of a good hero, the natural people who people respect, the leaders of state, if they are not up to the standard, then the people find least qualified personalities to worship and put pictures upon their walls. It goes down to only four types. There's the sports heroes, there's the rock and roll heroes, and there's the movie heroes, and then I think there's no other. Is there anyone else? Well, that's the basic. The queen. Who? Never heard of her. God save the queen. So, This is the condition of modern civilization. People are aching for personalities to look up to, who will elevate them, actually. And people have become so cynical about the political leaders and the people who are naturally the true leaders of society. So Krishna wanted Yudhisthira Maharaj to be the king, because he would govern by religious principles. He also wanted to establish again the Kuru dynasty, because the Kuru dynasty had been exhausted by the bamboo fire of anger. Why is this example of the bamboo fire of anger used? What is a bamboo fire? A bamboo fire is one in which there is no cause of the fire being ignited. It's not that someone lights the fire, but rather by the friction of the bamboos in the forest, sparks form, and by the formation of the sparks, the fire is ignited. So this point is actually explained. The idea is that Krishna himself did not cause this battle, even though he wanted Yudhisthira to be the king. He was not the cause of the battle of Kurukshetra. Kunti Devi explains this in text 28 of chapter 8, she says, "My Lord, I consider your lordship to be eternal time, the supreme controller without beginning and end, the all-pervasive one. In distributing mercy, you are equal to everyone. The dissensions between living beings are due to social intercourse." So social intercourse means social interaction. And the interaction is compared here to the interaction of bamboos in the forest when the wind is blowing, causing a fire to begin. So it was the actual interaction between the envious Duryodhana and the pious Pandavas that caused the battle. Krishna actually tried to stop the battle. So by that battle, the Kuru dynasty was more or less exhausted. It was finished. But Yudhisthira was placed in control as the king. So after having heard the words of Bhishmadev and Lord Krishna, Yudhisthira engaged in ruling the kingship with his younger brothers. Prabhupada explains there's one line in the purport, or two lines in the purport I'd like to read. In text 3 he says, "If the person is perfect, it is the person who rules and not the impersonal government. It is the person who rules and not the impersonal government. If the person is perfect, the government is perfect. If the person is a fool, the government is a fool's paradise. That is the law of nature." Stated very succinctly by Srila Prabhupada. It is not the system. The system can be perfect, but if an imperfect person is placed in the perfect system, it will not work, because it is the person who makes it work. So this is actually what is required to have perfect personalities. This is actually the secret in the Krishna consciousness movement, because when things aren't working properly in the world or anywhere in the movement, naturally the first thing we want to do is change all the systems. But what's always really required is powerful and perfect persons. But it's so much easier to change the system than to find perfect persons, but really it's much easier to change the system and search for others to be perfect than to become perfect persons. This is the real challenge of our existence. And the weight of that challenge, usually when this topic or something like this topic comes up, we think it's not, that challenge isn't meant for me. But actually, the challenge is meant for us. each and every one of us, regardless of the externals of our situation. These points are explained, probably in this part of the Bhagavatam. It is simply one's sincerity that gives one the opportunity, the desire, the sincere desire to serve Krishna. When that desire becomes overwhelming to us, that will burn to ashes all the impediments and obstacles that stop us from advancement in Krishna consciousness. It is the person, not the system. If the person is perfect, the government is perfect. If the person is a fool, the government is a fool's paradise. What is the meaning of fool's paradise? Such a funny term, a fool's paradise.
Thinking that it's a wonderful thing when actually everything is going to ruin.
It's going to ruin, right? Everything is horrible, and thinking how wonderful it is, like the goats being lined up to have their heads chopped off in the slaughterhouse, and as long as someone's handing them some grains, they're thinking this is a great place, not understanding that so quickly their heads are going to be chopped off and their blood is going to spurt out from their necks in incredible pain. Fool's paradise. So Yudhisthira Maharaj, with his brother's help, based on the instructions of Bhishma Dev and Sri Krishna, the infallible Lord, ruled. Text 4. Now what was that? What was the kingdom like when Yudhisthira was ruling through religious principles? Now Prabhupada in his purports, we'll read some of them because they're quite powerful. Prabhupada speaks very strongly about the potency and the good of spiritually based government and the contrasting that to materialistic government. So what I'm going to do is read several verses up to verse 7, and then we'll read some parts of the purports. During the reign of Maharaj Yudhisthira, the clouds showered all the water that people needed, and the earth produced all the necessities of man in profusion. Due to its fatty milk bags and cheerful attitude, the cow used to moisten the grazing ground with milk. The rivers, oceans, hills, mountains, forests, creepers, and active drugs in every season paid their tax quota to the king in profusion. Because of the king's having no enemy, the living beings were not at any time disturbed by mental agonies, diseases, or excessive heat or cold. That's up to text 6. So very, very different, especially that last verse, that people were not disturbed due to the piety of Yudhisthira Maharaj. They were not disturbed by mental agonies. Nowadays, everyone is so much agonized by the modern cultural situation, but because everyone is so addicted, hopelessly addicted to sense gratification, they won't get to the root of the problem. They want to change the system and change that and move this around just to facilitate what they think is going to be their pleasure in the form of more sense gratification, but they don't get to the basic root of the problem, which is that sense gratification and happiness are impossible combinations. Sense gratification and frustration, distress, born of both are born of the motive passion, unlimited desires. Because no one will talk about another purpose in life, purpose of life being to avoid sense gratification, to minimize our needs, material needs, rather than to increase our material needs, to minimize our material needs and use our time to develop our love of God using our human life properly. Everything can be there. The basis can be there, but the basics of life should be geared in such a way that we develop our love for Krishna, not become more and more entangled in unlimited, unsatisfiable needs, so-called needs, wants. So I'll read some points from Prabhupada's purport. The basic principles of economic development is centered on land and cows. The necessities of human society of food grains, fruits, milk, minerals, clothing, wood, etc. One requires all these items to fulfill the material needs of the body. Certainly, one does not require flesh and fish or iron tools and machinery. During the regime of Maharaj Yudhisthira, all over the world, there were regulated rainfalls. Rainfalls are not in the control of the human beings. The heavenly king Indradev is the controller of rains, and he is the servant of the Lord. When the Lord is obeyed by the kings and the people under the king's administration, there are regulated rains from the horizon, and these rains are the causes of all varieties of production on the land. Not only do regulated rains help ample production of grains and fruits, but when they combine with astronomical influences, there is an ample production of valuable stones and pearls. Grains and vegetables can sumptuously feed a man and animals. And a fatty cow delivers enough milk to supply a man sumptuously with vigor and vitality. If there is enough milk, enough grains, enough fruit, enough cotton, enough silk, and enough jewels, then why do the people need cinemas, houses of prostitution, slaughterhouses, etc.? What is the need of an artificial luxurious life of cinemas, cars, radios, flesh, and hotels? Has this civilization produced anything but quarreling individually and nationally? That is the question. Although we are all addicted to so much sense gratification, has it produced the satisfaction that we would have guessed, hoped, and wished to come through satisfying our desires? Or instead, has dissatisfaction, anxiety, and quarreling increased? But no one wants to ask that question, individually and nationally. Has this civilization enhanced the cause of equality and fraternity by sending thousands of men into a hellish factory and the war fields at the whim of a particular man? Since Maharaj Yudhisthira was under the protection of Ajita, the infallible Lord, as above mentioned, the properties of the Lord, namely the rivers, oceans, hills, forests, etc., were all pleased, and they used to supply their respective quota of taxes to the king. The secret to success is to take refuge under the protection of the Supreme Lord. Without his sanction, nothing can be possible. To make economic development by our own endeavors, by the strength of tools and machinery, is not all. The sanction of the Supreme Lord must be there. Otherwise, despite all instrumental arrangements, everything will be unsuccessful. The ultimate cause of success is the Daiva, the Supreme. Kings like Maharaj Yudhisthira knew perfectly well that the king is the agent of the Supreme Lord to look after the welfare of the mass of people. Actually, the state belongs to the Supreme Lord. The rivers, oceans, forests, hills, drugs, etc. are not the creations of man. They are all creations of the Supreme Lord, and the living entity is allowed to make use of the property of the Lord for the service of the Lord. And the last section of this. To be non-violent to human beings and to be a killer or enemy of the poor animals is Satan's philosophy. One time it is described how Srila Bhakti Siddhanta was walking down the road and he saw some, supposedly, this is in Navadvip, some of the aristocratic, someone in an aristocratic family carrying a fish like that. And he just commented, "So hard-hearted." Because how hard-hearted a man has to become to kill, to take the life, to slaughter, to murder innocent, defenseless living entities. What to speak of create these slaughterhouses, which is a conspiracy to kill the animals, a whole joint effort to kill the animals. How hard-hearted one has to be to do that and not feel any compunction, not feel any internal remorse, misery that he's doing something horrible. How hard-hearted a man has to be like that. How callous, up to the degree of killing children in the womb, killing human beings, cutting off their heads. Someone was telling me they saw some documentary of some wars in, going on at this day, just within the last few years. Just cutting off people's heads. Just the most disgraceful. How hard-hearted, callous, cruel, demonic has mankind become? Innocent people too. Women, children, old people. So this is Satan's philosophy. We'll be kind to man and cruel to the animals, and think we won't get in trouble for that. In this age, there is always enmity towards the poor animals, and therefore the poor creatures are always anxious. The reactions of the poor animals is being forced on human society, and therefore there is always the strain of cold or hot war between men, individually, collectively, or nationally. So therefore everyone has so many, everyone's fearful and disturbed. At the time of Maharaj Yudhisthira, there were no different nations, although there were different subordinate states. The whole world was united, and the supreme head, being a trained king like Yudhisthira, kept all the inhabitants free from anxiety, diseases, which are basically caused by anxiety, and excessive heat and cold. They were not only economically well-to-do, but also physically fit and undisturbed by supernatural powers, by enmity from other living beings, and by disturbances of bodily and mental agonies. There's a proverb in Bengal that a bad king spoils the kingdom and a bad housewife spoils the family. This truth is applicable here also. Because the king was pious and obedient to the Lord and sages, because he was no one's enemy, and because he was a recognized agent of the Lord and therefore was protected by him, all the citizens under the king's protection were, so to speak, directly protected by the Lord and his authorized agents. Unless one is pious and recognized by the Lord, he cannot make others happy who are under his care. So Yudhisthira, this was an answer to the question of Shonaka about how did Yudhisthira do, what did he do, how did he rule the kingdom? And the answer was, he ruled it not for his own sense gratification with great attachment to the post, but rather he ruled the kingdom as service to the Lord, as the Lord's agent for the benefit of the citizens, so that they would become more elevated in consciousness. So that is the answer to how Yudhisthira did. He did very well. And at that time still, although he had tried to leave, we have even seen how Krishna had tried to leave after the battle of Kurukshetra. He left, but then he had to protect Yudhisthira, Uttara, and Prikit Maharaj within her womb. Then he heard Kunti Devi's prayers. Then in answer to the misery and anguish that Yudhisthira was experiencing, he brought Yudhisthira and the Pandavas to see Bhishma. And in this way, he showed Bhishma Dev his special mercy, and Yudhisthira became instructed by Bhishma Dev. And then, Srihari, Lord Sri Krishna, resided at Hastinapur for a few months to pacify his relatives and please his own sister, Subhadra Devi. So he stayed to give Yudhisthira the support he needed, Krishna did, and he also had to pacify his sister Subhadra, because Subhadra's husband Abhimanyu was killed. Son. Yes. Subhadra, yes, she lost her only son. And Arjuna was her husband. Abhimanyu was just married and he was killed. So Krishna spent time satisfying her, Subhadra Devi. Then, afterwards, when the Lord asked permission to depart, and the king gave it, Maharaj Yudhisthira gave it, the Lord offered his respects to Maharaj Yudhisthira by bowing down at his feet. He's the Supreme Lord, the source of everything, but yet he asked permission from Yudhisthira Maharaj, and he bowed at his feet, and the king embraced him, because Yudhisthira was his elder cousin. So Krishna always followed the etiquettes. After this, the Lord, being embraced by others and receiving their obeisances, got into his chariot. He was going to leave. Where was he going to? He was in Hastinapur now, and he was leaving for Dwarka. At that time, Subhadra, Dhritarashtra, Yuyutsu was one of the sons of someone. Yuyutsu, Kripacharja, Nakul, Sahadev, Bhima, Domya, and Satyavati, they all nearly fainted because it was impossible for them to bear separation from the Lord. They had been with Krishna. We should always remember that Krishna is not a position. He's a person. Person means that he has characteristics. He's a person who is all attractive, all beautiful, all strong. He's Bhagawan, all wealthy, all full of knowledge, full of bliss. Everything that attracts one in this world, this beautiful, wonderful Krishna possesses everything like that. So, naturally, everyone loves Krishna. So when Krishna was about to leave, everyone, even these great warriors, they nearly fainted because it was almost impossible for them to bear separation from the Lord. Sometimes if we have a guest staying at our house for some months, just counting the days before they leave. But Krishna stayed for months and months, and when he was ready to leave, everyone was about to die practically. They could not bear the thought of being apart from him. They were so used to his association. Here's Prabhupada's very wonderful purport in this regard. These next several verses. Describe how the people were feeling. Now remember, this Bhagavatam is meant to give us, to purify our heart and help us remember what we have forgotten and awaken us to what we are lacking. To have a person that after their association for a few months, if we lose their association, practically we die. Just imagine how wonderful that person is. Prabhupada's purport. Lord Sri Krishna is so attractive for the living beings, especially for the devotees, that it is impossible for them to tolerate separation. The conditioned soul under the spell of the illusory energy forgets the Lord. Otherwise, he cannot forget. The feelings of such separation cannot be described, but it can simply be imagined by devotees only. After his separation from Vrindavan and the innocent rural cowherd boys, girls, ladies, and others, they all felt shock throughout their lives. There's a story like that, what I once heard, an Eka Chakra story, how when after Nityananda Prabhu left Eka Chakra, where he was born when he was very young, how old? 6, 7? How old? Like that? 8, 9? Something like that. He was very young. Excuse me? Yes? You know? He was a young boy, and everyone loved him so much. And then, many, many, many years later, when Nityananda Prabhu had left this planet, when he had departed from this world, Janavamata went to Ekachakra, his Nityananda Prabhu's birthplace. And there was an old man crying and crying and crying and crying and crying and crying. She said, "Why are you crying?" He said, "Because Nityananda's left. He's gone." That means for years and years and years and years and years he had been crying. And years and years. Not that we just find someone else. That is not love. Love means that this person is so special there can be never anyone else. So, when Krishna left Vrindavan, all the residents of Vrindavan, the girls, the ladies, and others, they all felt shocked throughout their lives. And the separation of Radharani, the most beloved cowherd girl, is beyond expression. Once Krishna and the residents of Vrindavan, they met at Kurukshetra during a solar eclipse, and the feelings which were expressed by them is heart-rending. There is, of course, a difference in the quality of the transcendental devotees of the Lord, but none of them who have ever contacted the Lord by direct communion or otherwise can leave him for a moment. That is the attitude of a pure devotee. It's torture. Yugayitam namesena tashusaspe shayitam sunyayitam jagatsavam govindavirahena me. A moment, the universe appears to be empty. Mahaprabhu was praying without Govinda's association. Just imagine what that love is like. In a moment, is passing like 10,000 years missing Krishna. We can just imagine. So the next two verses. The intelligent who have understood the Supreme Lord in association with pure devotees and have become freed from bad materialistic association can never avoid hearing the glories of the Lord, even though they have heard them only once. How then could the Pandavas tolerate his separation? For they had been intimately associated with his person, seeing him face to face, touching him, conversing with him, and sleeping, sitting, and dining with him. So the Pandavas, these people, if the devotees, just after hearing about the Lord even one time, can't give up his association, imagine, just imagine what the Pandavas were going through. They had done everything with Krishna. The Pandavas could not even think of separation from Sri Krishna, since the attraction was more intense for them because of their continuous personal contact. All their hearts were melting for him on the pot of attraction. They looked at him without blinking their eyes, and they moved hither and thither in perplexity. No one knew what to do. The female relatives, whose eyes were flooded with tears out of anxiety for Krishna, came out of the palace. They could stop their tears only with great difficulty. They feared that tears would cause misfortune at the time of departure, so they were stopping their tears. Here's Prabhupada's purport. There were hundreds of ladies in the palace of Hastinapur. All of them were affectionate to Krishna. All of them were relatives also. When they saw that Krishna was going away from the palace for his native place, they were very anxious for him, and as usual, tears began to roll down their cheeks. They thought at the same time that tears at that moment might be a cause of misfortune for Krishna. Therefore, they wanted to check them. This was very difficult for them because the tears could not be checked. Therefore, they smeared their tears in their eyes, and their hearts throbbed. Therefore, ladies who were the wives and daughters-in-law of those who died in the battlefield, never came in direct contact with Krishna, but all of them heard of him and his great activities, and thus they thought of him, talked of him, his name, fame, etc., and became affectionate also, like those who were in direct contact. Therefore, directly or indirectly, anyone who thinks of Krishna, talks of Krishna, or worships Krishna becomes attached to him. Because Krishna is absolute, there is no difference between his name, form, quality, etc. Our intimate relation with Krishna can be confidentially revived by our talking of, hearing of, or remembering him. It is so done due to spiritual potency. So there are very important instructions here how we can advance. We are meant to become attracted to Krishna. While the Lord was departing from the palace of Hastinapur, different types of drums, like the madangas, dolas, nagras, dunduri, and dundubi, and flutes of different types, the veena, gomukha, and bedi, all sounded together to show him honor. Out of loving desire to see the Lord, the royal ladies of the Kurus got on top of the palace, and smiling with affection and shyness, they showered flowers upon the Lord. Read half of the purport, the second half of the purport by Srila Prabhupada. Human civilization, as conceived of by the sages of India, is to help one free himself from the clutches of illusion. That means to become attracted to Krishna and to leave illusion, attraction to Maya, far away. The material beauty of a woman is an illusion, because actually the body is made of earth, water, fire, air, etc. But because there is the association of the living spark with matter, it appears to be beautiful. No one is attracted by an earthen doll, even if it is most perfectly prepared to attract the attention of others. The dead body has no beauty because no one will accept the dead body of a so-called beautiful woman. Therefore, the conclusion is that the spirit spark is beautiful. And because of the soul's beauty, one is attracted by the beauty of the outward dress, of the outward body. The Vedic wisdom therefore forbids us to be attracted by false beauty. But because we are now in the darkness of ignorance, the Vedic civilization allows very restricted mixing of woman and man. They say that the woman is compared to be the fire, and the man is considered to be the butter. The butter must melt in association with fire, and therefore they may be brought together only when it is necessary. And shyness is a check to the unrestricted mixing. It is nature's gift and it must be utilized. So shyness is the, and chasteness is the beauty and the quality of women that bring the most respect. So the ladies went on the roofs and smiled at the Lord, the Kuru royalty, and threw flowers down, petals of flowers and flowers, to glorify the Lord. At that time, Arjuna, the great warrior and conqueror of sleep, Gudakesh, who is the intimate friend of the most beloved Supreme Lord, took up an umbrella which had handles of jewels and was embroidered with lace and pearls. These things are auspicious. Uddhava and Satyaki began to fan the Lord with decorated fans. And the Lord, as the master of Madhu, seated on scattered flowers, commanded them along the road. It was being heard here and there that the benedictions being paid to Krishna were neither befitting nor unbefitting, because they were all for the Absolute, who was now playing the part of a human being. So remember, while Krishna is walking down the road and the flowers are being thrown down upon him with all opulence and affection, and people are holding an auspicious umbrella and whisk, chamar whisk above him, great devotees, great intimate associates are doing that. People, the brahmanas, are offering blessings to Krishna. And this verse describes how they were befitting and non-befitting, because the blessings superficially were materialistic. May you live long, may this happen, may you be safe, may you gain wealth, may this, like that. So how are those appropriate for the absolute truth, who is the creator of universes, not even this universe, not the control of this universe, but all unlimited universes? But yet, as Prabhupada explains in the purport, because they were offered to Krishna, they were connected with Krishna, it was considered befitting and appropriate. And then from the other side, thinking of him as the absolute truth, not appropriate, how could you? But yes, appropriate. So Krishna was acting as if he was the king of Dwarka, and he was heading back home. Absorbed in the thought of the transcendental qualities of the Lord, who is sung in select poetry, the ladies on the roofs of the houses of Hastinapur began to talk of him. This talk was more attractive than the hymns of the Vedas. So, because the Vedic hymns are indirectly glorifying Krishna, and the ladies, the words of the ladies, because the subject was the direct glorification of Krishna, Krishna appreciated their words, even though the Sanskrit may not have been as perfect. Krishna appreciated their words far more. Because, as Prabhupada explains in the purport, that is the subject matter that is important. And it is the sentiment, the affection that the subject matter is delivered with, that is important. Because someone can say some flowery words in praise of someone else, but if their relationship is not intimate, does not touch the person's heart. He may appreciate it, that it's being spoken, but it does not touch. So the ladies, the royal ladies on top of the roofs, began to speak about Krishna. Now listen to what they say. First they, remember, Krishna's walking down the road, and first they're going to inform us, remind us, who this Krishna actually is. Here he is, the original personality of Godhead, as we definitely remember him. He alone existed before the manifested creation of the modes of nature, and in him only, because he is the Supreme Lord, all the living beings merge, as if sleeping at night, their energy suspended. So before anything existed, he existed. We'll hear about this when we hear the second and third canto. It is described three times in the third canto. How first there was nothing but Krishna. And then he, by his glance into the Pradhan, starts the creation going. And then, after the creation is there for some time, it is wound up within him again. And nothing exists again but him. And all the living entities are within his body, their activities suspended in practically asleep. That Lord, who is the origin of all living entities, and within whom all living entities rest, is walking down the road. The personality of Godhead, again desiring to give names and forms to his parts and parcels, the living entities, placed them under the guidance of material nature. With the exhaling of Vishnu, the living entities come out of his transcendental body and are placed again within the universes, and they again take up material names and forms, and they are again placed under the control of the material energy for the purpose of them making spiritual advancement. By his own potency, material nature is empowered to recreate. So Krishna empowers Maya Dakshina Prakriti Siyate Satya. So this Krishna is walking down the road. So how can anyone know? Because there he is, two legs, two arms, a crown. Yes, he's beautiful. But how can anyone know his position? They know his position. Yudhisthira Maharaj knows his position. Arjuna knows his position. Bhishma Dev knew his position. What did the lady say? Here is the same Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose transcendental form is experienced by the great devotees who are completely cleansed of material consciousness by dint of rigid devotional service and full control of life and senses, and that is the only way to purify existence. So great sages, due to the depth of their Krishna consciousness, they know who Krishna is. Oh dear friends, they say, here is that very personality of Godhead whose attractive and confidential pastimes are described in the confidential parts of Vedic literature by his great devotees. It is he only who creates, maintains, and annihilates the material world, and yet he remains unaffected. So they've described how it is practically, unless one is a devotee, it is impossible. Bhaktiya tvananiya shakyo hameva vidyajana gyatum jastum paveshtena paveshtum cha parantapa. Only by pure devotional service, Krishna says, can I be known as I am. Two arms standing before you, he tells Arjuna. We've heard that, and we've heard that he, that person, is the Supreme Lord. So here it is summarized, that although he is the creator of everything, it is only he who does everything. There is no second doer. He is the absolute truth that all other truths rest upon. And yet, he is completely aloof. This is Krishna's achintya shakti. Everything is resting on him. Everything is coming from him. And yet he has nothing to do with anything. This is inconceivable. Krishna's inconceivable potency. He does everything, and yet he is completely aloof, doing nothing. Now why has that all-powerful person who has inconceivable potency, what is he doing here? Why has he come? So now in text 25, the queens explain the purpose of his advent. Now, first they've explained one aspect of Krishna. Now they're going to be moving. And you'll see the movement of their words in a different direction, to glorifying him in a completely different way. Because when we glorify the Supreme Lord, we most appreciate the glories of his power, his opulence. But they're going to move the glorification in a different way. Why does that all-powerful person come to this earth first? Whenever there are kings and administrators living like animals in the lowest mode of existence, animals have no compunction, as we were saying, no remorse. They just kill, exploit, do whatever they like. They have no higher consciousness, no conscience. So whenever the administrators are like that, the Lord in his transcendental form manifests his supreme power, the truth positive. He shows special mercy to the faithful, performs wonderful activities, and manifests various transcendental forms as it is necessary in different periods of an age. So Krishna explains this point in the Bhagavad Gita. Yadai yadai dhamasya bhavir glaniya bhaviti bharatat bhuttanam adhamasya tadatmanam shrijabhityaham paritranaya sadunam vinashaya chadaskidam dharma samstapanataya sambhavami yuge yuge. Krishna explains that he comes to do just this: protect the devotees and to annihilate the miscreants. He comes in so many different incarnations. Yadai yadai dhamasya. So many different times he comes. This is the purpose of his incarnations, is necessary. Now, why? So that's many, many incarnations that Krishna comes so many times. But here, He has come as Krishna. This particular incarnation is very special, actually. This is the Bhagawan Swayam. Bhishma Dev has said this. He is the original Narayan. Lord Brahma says it in the 10th canto. He is the origin of all personalities of Godhead. So now they say, getting more specific about Krishna, how supremely glorified is the dynasty of King Yadu, and how virtuous is the land of Mathura, where the supreme leader of all living beings, the husband of the goddess of fortune, has taken his birth and wandered in his childhood. So this is an indirect glorification of Krishna, because he is so glorious that the family, the Yadu dynasty in which he was born, has become glorious due to his glory. And the land in which he lived and grew up, the land of Mathura, is similarly glorious due to his having walked and wandered there in his childhood and having been born there. So these purports of Prabhupada's are all very wonderful, and we should, if we haven't read them recently, we should read them. They're very exciting. So now, after explaining that the Lord is so glorious because he comes for the purpose that he's come, and after having explained that the land and the family in which the Lord walks on, takes birth in, is glorious, now he's talking about, they're going to speak about the place where Krishna is going. And what is that place? He's leaving Hastinapur, and where is he going? To Dwarka. Undoubtedly, it is wonderful that Dwarka has defeated the glories of the heavenly planets, and it has enhanced the celebrity of the earth. The earth has become glorious due to Dwarka's being there. The inhabitants of Dwarka, now getting more specific, the place is glorious. Now how about the people who live in Dwarka? Because Krishna is living there with them continuously, while he's been in Hastinapur for several months, but he lives continuously in Dwarka. So how fortunate are the residents of Dwarka? Because remember, these ladies and all the people of Hastinapur, they're crying. They're practically dead in feeling separation from Krishna. They can't even bear the thought, tolerate the thought of not being with Krishna, who they've been with for several months straight, and they have become used to him, his association, his all-sweet personality. We're so unfortunate, they're thinking, now Krishna's leaving us. Now how fortunate are the residents of Dwarka? The inhabitants of Dwarka, now they describe that, are always seeing the soul of all living beings, Krishna, in his loving features. He glances at them and favors them with sweet smiles. So everyone in Dwarka is so fortunate because they see the Lord, and sometimes he glances at them, he smiles at them. This is for everyone in Dwarka. Now getting even more specific, text 28, they say, O friends, just think of his wives, more fortunate, most fortunate, whose hands he has accepted. How they must have undergone vows, baths, fire sacrifices, and perfect worship of the Lord of the universe to constantly relish now the nectar from his lips by kissing. And then, describing this incredible position, why is the position of the queens of Dwarka, Mahishi, why is their position so incredibly glorious? Because it's intimate. Their intimacy is greater than those of the general residents of Dwarka. They're his wives, the queens. Such an intimate relationship with Krishna. It's called sambandatmika. So how pious, how pure, how fortunate these personalities are, because their relationship was so intimate. It is with Krishna so intimate. But this intimacy is not, does not give them the facility to enjoy Krishna. Rather, it is an intimacy for service to Krishna. Now, here the queens of Dwarka are being mentioned, just mentioned. But in the next chapter, we'll hear about them more. And right at the end of the chapter, which we will continue and hear, if Krishna allows, by the end of the week, we'll hear very, very wonderful, very deep philosophy about the intimate associates and servants of the Lord. But then, next, after describing the intimacy and fortune of the queens of Dwarka, then the ladies say the damsels of Brajabhumi would often faint just by expecting such favors. So on one hand, when we hear this, the first natural thought is that who is more fortunate? The residents, the queens of Dwarka, who are favored by the kiss of the Lord, who actually obtain that, or the damsels of Brajabhumi, who would faint just by expecting such favors. It sounds like the queens are more fortunate because they are getting those favors. But actually there are hints here of the incredible intimacy and fortune and ecstatic serving mood of the gopis, because rather than even getting it and being fortunate, they'd be fallen to the highest ecstasy of fainting just expecting such favors. So their position is actually the highest. They have no relationship with Krishna. They take nothing from Krishna. They have given everything fully to Krishna. So I'll read Srila Prabhupada's purport to this verse. Prescribed in the scriptures are meant to purify the mundane qualities of the conditioned souls to enable them to gradually be promoted to the stage of rendering transcendental service to the Supreme Lord. Attainment of this stage of pure spiritual life is the highest perfection. And this stage is called Swarupa, or the factual identity of the living being. Liberation means renovation of this stage of Sarupa. In that perfect stage of Sarupa, the living being is established in five phases of loving service, one of which is Madhurya Ras, or the humor of conjugal love. The Lord is always perfect in himself, and thus he has no hankering for himself. He, however, becomes a master, a friend, a son, or a husband to fulfill the intense love of the devotee concerned. Herein, two classes of devotees of the Lord are mentioned in the state of conjugal love. One is Swakya and the other is Parakya. Both of them are in conjugal love with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. The queens of Dwarka were Swakya, or duly married wives, but the damsels of Braja were young friends of the Lord while he was unmarried. The Lord stayed at Vrindavan till the age of 16. And his friendly relations with the neighboring girls were in the terms of parakya. These girls, as well as the queens, underwent severe penances by taking vows, bathing, and offering sacrifices in the fire, as prescribed in the scriptures. The rites, as they are not an end in themselves, nor a fruit of action, culture of knowledge, or perfection in mystic powers ends in themselves. They are all meant to attain the highest stage of sarup, to render constitutional transcendental service to the Lord. Each and every living being has his individual position in one of the above mentioned five different kinds of reciprocating means with the Lord, and in one's pure spiritual form of sarup, the relation becomes manifest without mundane affinity. The kissing of the Lord, either by his wives or his young girlfriends who aspired to have the Lord as their fiancé, is not of any mundane perverted quality. Had such things been mundane, A liberated soul like Sukadev would not have taken the trouble to relish them, nor would Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu have been inclined to participate in those subjects after renouncing worldly life. The stage is earned after many lives of penances. So the queens are describing this exalted position that has nothing to do with matter. Intimacy of serving, loving devotional service to Krishna. The perfection of religion. And then the children of these ladies, like Prajumna, Samba, Amba, etc., ladies like Rukmini, Satchabalman, Jambavati, were forcibly taken away from him, by him from their Swayamvara ceremony after he defeated many powerful kings headed by Shishupal. And other ladies were also forcibly taken away by him after he killed Bhomasura and thousands of his assistants. All of these ladies are glorious. So the next verse explains more about that second part, about the queens, the 16,000 queens taken by Krishna who were being imprisoned by Bhomasura, and then we'll read the purport to that, and then we'll end. And there's some very, very important points for us in here. All these women auspiciously glorified their lives despite their being without individuality and without purity, because they were all six, so many thousands of them were kidnapped, and they were praying to Krishna, praying to Krishna, please come and take us. And Krishna took all of them without individually taking them, and they were being captive by a man, so therefore their purity was either lost or deeply, at least deeply in question. In Vedic culture, they would have never been accepted for marriage by anyone. Vedic culture was so strict. If a girl was missing for one night, she was unaccounted for. No one would marry her. Even if she had done nothing innocently, but no one would marry her. So these girls were without purity. They were out without individually, en masse. Krishna took 1,000 of, rescued 16,000 of them. But yet, their husband, he accepted them as their husband, as his wife, and he became their husband. The lotus-eyed personality of Godhead never left them alone at home. He always pleased their hearts by making valuable presentations. Anyway, won't read the purport. But the point being that Prabhupada actually explains it in the previous, oh no, here it is. In the previous purport. There were other queens also taken away by Lord Krishna in a similar way. Full description of this beautiful booty of Lord Krishna will be given in the 10th canto. There were 16,100 beautiful girls who were daughters of many kings and were forcibly stolen by Bhomasura. All these captive princesses were then accepted by the Lord as his wives, although in the estimation of society they were all fallen girls. The all-powerful Lord Krishna accepted the humble prayers of these girls and married them with the adoration of queens. So the point being that regardless of what one's position is, if one has an intense and humble desire to serve Krishna in a particular way, Krishna will rescue one. Because this is actually everyone's position. We're all captured by Maya. And we're being exploited continuously by other living entities in Maya. We attempt to exploit, but rather than gaining the position of exploiter, we become exploited. When the living entity becomes tired of this, and does not want to exploit or be exploited anymore, he has to fully surrender to Krishna, even though still within the prison of Bhomajura, like the queens were. They prayed humbly to Krishna, and Krishna took them despite their impurity, despite their lack of individuality in that sense. He took them and accepted them and treated them so wonderfully. So this is a great inspiration for us who are really imprisoned. He always pleased their hearts by making valuable presentations. So while the ladies of the capital of Hastinapur were greeting Krishna and talking in this way, the Lord, smiling, accepted their good greetings, and casting the grace of his glance over them, he departed from the city. So Krishna left Hastinapur. Okay, thank you very much. Ooh.